This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM.
Arnie Sherman, a good Sunday morning.
Good Sunday morning to you, Scott. How are you doing? Spring has sprung, and we're thankful for that, for sure.
Agreed.
We have an interesting guest today. There's a friend of mine and colleague of mine for almost 40 years, if you can believe that, Peter Galtz, who is a well-respected and well-known aviation and transportation expert, formerly the managing director for the National Transportation Safety Board for a number of years. And in his post-retirement from that, he's very active in lots of other things, but no longer in the administration. He's been a senior correspondent industry expert for CNN. You know, unfortunately for Peter, most of the time I see him, it's because there was a major accident of some kind, and I turn on TV on to watch it, and then there's Peter, you know, being brought in to comment on it. You know, most recently, the one he got the most exposure related to was the January 29th American Airlines Sikorsky helicopter incident at National Airport in Reagan Airport in D.C., where 67 people died. So I usually get to see Peter when it's not a very happy occasion, but he always has good insights and good perspective on these things, and gives us a look at the inner workings of how this all comes to a closure or comes to a knowledgeable end. And so I enjoy having him on the show. We've had him as a guest a couple of times previously, and it's always we get new information, new insights, and a better understanding of a very important industry to all of us.
Yeah, we have a lot of questions for Peter, especially given the most recent events that have happened over the last 90 days.
Yep.
And our curiosity around, you know, in air transport and air transportation, commercial aviation, you and I always seem to bring in guests that kind of tickle that funny bone for us. I appreciate it. Anyway, when we come back, our guest will be former head of the NTSB and senior CNN aviation consultant, Peter Galtz. Back after this. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Peter Galtz, who is the former managing director of the NTSB and a senior aviation contributor to CNN.
Peter, it's good to have you back on the show. It's always good to try to catch up with you on all things aviation, all the positive things about the world, accidents, shortage of air traffic controllers, airline fatigue, all those good, happy topics to go over with you. How you been?
I'm good, but it's been a challenging few months, needless to say.
Yeah, we thought it would be a good time, by the way, to have you back, Peter, just so you know. Arnie and I have been talking about this since January 20th. So,
yeah. So just to put a big picture spin on this, National Transportation Safety Board, is a group that, among other things, investigates aviation accidents and oversees, safety in the industry. And since the beginning of this year, there have been 87 U.S. domestic aviation accidents, 21 of them deadly, 108 people died. The majority of them died in the accident that happened on January 29th when the American Airlines flight collided with the U.S. military Sikorsky helicopter, and 67 people died. So let me just ask you, before we delve into that, is this normal? Are we up? Are we down? Is this average? There's a lot of speculation of what's going on in the industry. 3 months into the year, what's the take on it?
Well, I think it's not fair to take 3 months out of a period of time and say this is representative of some sort of sea change in the safety of aviation in our country. I mean, we're still the safest in the world when it comes to air transport. There have been a couple of accidents that have occurred, but previous to that, the last major fatal accident was in 2009 outside of Buffalo at the Colgan accident. So we had an extraordinarily safe decade or 14 years without any major accidents. So now we had one, and the NTSB has not seen a particular uptick in general aviation accidents or in business accidents. They're running about normal for this time of year. But certainly the coverage of these accidents has been extraordinary. And the combination of the accident on the Potomac, the accident up in Toronto, and the sudden closure of Heathrow for a day, that's all got everybody on edge.
And the one in Philadelphia, Peter, the medevac flight that crashed in Philadelphia. What I am curious about is I go to the FAA website and I just look up incidents and accidents, and I look at it, and literally every day there are several incidents being re reported. That's normal, correct?
That's right. That is normal.
But and what's an incident versus an a I mean, what is tell what's an incident?
Well, sometimes it's a dollar amount, the amount of property that's been damaged. Sometimes it's injuries. Certainly, if it's a fatality, it's an accident. If a general aviation plane simply goes off the runway and wrecks its landing gear, that's an incident. And the NTSB is required by statute to investigate every fatal aviation accident. The reality is they don't. They delegate some of that authority to the FAA, but they tend to look at the fatal accidents that have broader application. Certainly the one in Philly, they looked at very carefully. It was a high-profile tragedy. People don't realize, not 10 days ago, a rotorcraft medical air evac crashed down in Mississippi, killing three. So it happens, and the NTSB tries to get to it. I don't think they're going to get much on the Philly accident, frankly. There just isn't enough evidence to get to a probable cause, but I know they're working it hard.
And
So
isn't
you
it extraordinary, though, that something like that would happen? So is it, a catastrophic failure of some system or weather-related thing? Like, how do they even narrow it down to say this is what it is?
what's that on the Philadelphia accident specifically?
The
Yeah,
Philadelphia accident.
that's a very difficult one because, they had just taken off. They weren't higher than 1,000 feet. They never sent out an emergency call. There was never a mayday. And the data recorder and voice recorder was not connected. So there was no evidence on the aircraft that would give them a direction in which to go. Now they will go look at the remnants of the engine, remnants of the wreckage, but it was such a catastrophic fire that went on for so long. I really don't think they're going to find much. The only thing that on a medevac flight you worry about is the supplemental oxygen system on it, right? And oxygen inside a pressurized, closed environment can be very dangerous and very flammable. And there'll be speculation that's where the attention should be. But we have no evidence to confirm that.
So you alluded, Peter, briefly in one of your earlier comments about more attention to these incidents and accidents. And I notice, by looking at the news, almost every day you're reading about a story of a plane having to turn back because there's a potential mechanical issue, or there's a unruly passenger, or just a day or so ago on a United flight, the pilot forgot his passport and he was headed to China and had to turn around and come back. Does this regularly happen, or are we just paying more attention and it's getting more news?
It does regularly happen,
Okay.
and I mean the reality is you've got pilots that forget their passport. You have pilots occasionally, rarely, get on the plane after they've had a drink and they've been taken off the plane for having alcohol on their breath. You get the unruly passenger situation went skyrocketing after the COVID crisis. Coming back from that for some reason. Now that's calmed down a little bit, but the coverage of these events has really, I think, been over the top in some cases.
You also have played a role in, historically working with flight attendants. Has their job become much more, unmanageable given all of these issues that are going on? I mean, they're not trained to be, crisis intervention, specialists. What's been
Well,
going on in
their
Alabama?
training, has changed over the years, and they do have, how to de-escalate situations. They do have how to respond to being physically attacked. But the reality is, flight attendant jobs have really, really become challenging. And I did work for the American Airlines flight attendants for over a decade, and help them. Develop their training and help them, but they it is they're in the unenviable position where passengers tend to see them primarily as servant agents, service agents.
Right.
Bring me a soda, bring me a cocktail, and not as safety professionals. But I'll tell you, when the plane was upside in Toronto, it was the flight attendants who got people off it, and they're trained for that.
Right.
And I think they've performed admirably in some recent accidents.
Right. I mean, if you're a waiter or a waitress in a restaurant and somebody's unruly, you can walk out the door. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do. When you're on a plane at 36,000 feet and something's going on, it's a completely different kind of
Well, that's
environment to try to operate in.
that begs and that begs the question, do the airlines need to go a little further, Peter, in terms of being able to communicate to passengers just the importance of who the flight attendants are and safety being, I mean, they kind of say that, but it's like how else can they communicate it in
Well, they
advance
need
of
to
even getting
be.
on the plane?
The flight attendants feel pretty strongly that the air carriers need to be more aggressive in identifying what their role is and that how they need to be responded to inside the aircraft. And they also feel strongly that the FAA and the U.S. attorneys need to prosecute people who act out on planes, who take swings at flight attendants, who cause disruptions. But on the upside, passengers are now stepping up to help flight attendants. When there are disruptions in the aircraft, my flight attendants tell me that they get a lot of help from other passengers. And they subdue the people who are acting out, and they're so there's some good to this increased attention to it, but it's still an awfully hard job.
I have a follow-up question. Isn't there like there's some psychology of the passenger, of the collective group of passengers, where it's an unnatural act to be hurling through the through the 36,000 feet in the air at 600 miles an hour. I mean, you can't get your head around it. You feel unsafe, yet you feel you're supposed to feel safe. It's like nothing else. It's not like a bus where you know what it's like to be on the road because you drive on the road.
And even though driving your own car is far more dangerous than getting in the plane, you feel like you have some false sense of control over your life when you're sitting behind the wheel of a car. The reality is somebody can smack into you without any forewarning. But the flight attendants, I think, they do a little more training in de-escalation, a little more training in psychology, and they need a little more support from the air carriers in that early announcement phase, that the people need to pay attention to these flight attendants. And you know, the number one thing, and if you've seen it in some of these recent arguments, accidents, is, you know, if, you know, God forbid you're in an accident and you survive it and you're on the ground, don't go for your overhead luggage.
Right.
Leave it there and get the hell out. I mean, that's, and you see guys, I saw people standing on the wing of the plane up in
Denver,
up in Toronto with their bags in their hands. You say, come on.
Right. Yeah. Well, how about Denver? How about Denver, the flight that caught on
exactly.
fire?
Yeah. Excuse me. I need to get my Rolodex out of my bag.
It's
on my
fire.
Laptop.
Could you put the fire out of my bag so I can get my my stuff out of it? Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, though, Peter. Passengers have played a more important role. I was on a flight where there was a firefighter who was just as drunk as I've ever seen anybody. And he had alcohol with him on the plane and was hiding it.
Right.
The flight crew, and I was sitting, you know, right next to him. And, you know, I said to the flight, I went up to use the restroom, and I said to the flight attendant, this guy's got booze and he's really drunk. And she said, would you be willing to kind of chat with them and try to, you know, because he was, you know, talking to people and talking real, I mean, whatever. And as soon as, and I did, I kept talking to him and trying to, you know, distract him from, you know, what he was, because he was getting belligerent. And when the plane landed, obviously somebody came on and, you know, grabbed him and
escorted him.
And you hope you hope that somebody prosecuted him.
Yeah.
You know, it's against the law to be drunk on an airplane. It's against the law, federal law, to disrupt a flight and stuff. And you hope, you don't want to lock him up forever, but you want him to pay a price. And you know, one of the things that the flight attendants universally support is a no fly list domestically for those kinds of passengers.
Mm-hmm.
That if they're pulled off a flight for some sort of disruptive behavior, you don't fly for a year and see how you like it.
Right. This guy clearly knew he wasn't supposed to do this. He was popping beer cans that he had in his backpack on the plane and drinking them, you know, that kind of thing. And,
where is that enforced, by the way, Peter, that no fly? Is it when they make their tickets or their ticket arrangements or when they get up to TSA?
Yeah, it's a TSA responsibility now. But the flight attendants would like it expanded to be more than just a terrorism list, that it would be a disruptive behavior list as well, and that you would be put on it, you know, if you were convicted or issued a summons on disruptive behavior, and that would be it would last a year, and that would be it. Then you'd be off it. If you're on the terrorism list, I don't think you ever get off.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Exactly. Let me switch gears a little bit.
Yeah.
So we got a new administration, and they have Doge under Elon Musk's leadership. And after the January 29th, you know, incident, you know, and even before that, they were blaming air traffic controllers. And I understand that so far the investigation has shown there was no, you know, issues with the air traffic controller in that crash. And maybe you have some additional information. We have a shortage to begin with of air traffic controllers. I think we have, what, about 10,800 of them, and we need about 14,600.
Yeah, we're short 2,000 or 3,000.
Right.
Yeah.
And the retirement age is 56. I was surprised to learn that. That's a fairly young retirement age. I think that has to do with, and you know, I want you to elaborate on it, Peter, has to do with the fatigue and the stress. These guys are working 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, managing, you know, in some place like Chicago and other places, you know, just hundreds of flights a day. And they're, you know, they're the guy in, I believe one of the air traffic controllers in the tower on January 29th was doing two jobs at once because they were understaffed. They're hiring back some of the ones that they laid off. You know, they're, you know, recruiting more, you know, they're, what needs to be done? What's the current status of that? Because that's critical, you know, in terms of managing all of this. These planes are, taking off and landing in some airports every 30 seconds.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a number of problems, and they're interrelated. The first is that the system itself is largely antiquated. The technology, the computers, the systems that are in place, these are not cutting-edge systems. You know, they've been around for 10, 20 years. The FAA has been slow to replace the monitoring system. You know, we're still using radar to track many of the aircraft, and that's an antiquated and not
well,
particularly
precise. It's not precise.
Yeah, it's not precise. So you have that issue. The second thing is you have the issue that you raised. This is not an easy job. You know, at Reagan National, you can have 45 takeoffs and landings in an hour. You know, so that's that is a heavy workload. And you've got, you know, one major north-south runway, you've got a cross runway, and you have the helicopter traffic, which we'll get to later. So it is extraordinarily challenging to be a flight, to be a an air traffic controller. And the last 2 months has increased the pressure on these guys enormously, guys and women. You know, the for instance, at the NTSB, you know, which is the investigative agency, there's just over 400 people at the agency. And shortly after Trump was sworn in, every one of them, including the board members, got a notice that they could be fired and that they had until Thursday, whatever the date was, to respond. Now, that was rescinded in 48 hours, but still, it sent a devastating message to these guys mm-hmm. and women who are working every day in the grimmest possible environment, that in the back of at least somebody's mind, they were expendable. And now it's gone that they've avoided the axe, and I don't think Trump and his people could get away with firing them. But just the opening salvo was unnerving. Mm-hmm. The FAA also was being under pressure. You know, there are and the question, you know, the underlying question of the 2025 program, right? The design from the Heritage Foundation that they put in place is that at the core, they want to privatize the air traffic control system. Yeah, the United States has a publicly run, it's a part of the function of the government that air traffic control is operated. In Canada, in Australia, which are much smaller systems, and in much of Europe, it's privatized. And that's long been a holy grail for the conservatives, that what we should do is privatize the air traffic control system. I don't think they're going to get there, but they're going to try, and they'll do it around the edges. And the third thing with air traffic control is that the controllers, you know, as Arnie, you mentioned, there was one controller on the night of the Potomac crash who was handling two positions, both landing and takeoff aircraft and rotorcraft flying in the area. And that is not uncommon, that the towers are short-staffed and they try to do it at lesser times of the day when there's not so much traffic. But in any case, they are still doing two jobs and taking positions that should have been filled with an additional staff.
Let me get some clarification on one point here. Are military aircrafts, when they're in the air, controlled by these air traffic controllers?
When they are in certain areas, yes. Well, they have to, they check in. And if
right.
you saw the Black Hawk was on a training mission.
Right.
Was touching base with the air traffic controller, and the investigation will point out, will identify what happened. But I think it's pretty clear They were tracking a different aircraft than the one that the flight controller was identifying as the one to be tracked. So they were looking at a plane that was just taking off, not at the PSA plane that was coming in. But the real challenge was you have the approach layout for the aircraft on the cross runway. And that intersects with this well-traveled rotorcraft area, and the separation is less than 100 feet.
Oh, my God.
By design.
And, why?
Well, that's the question. Who thought that was a good idea?
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah, you've got aircraft coming in, and the PSA plane was dead on. You know, he's in final approach, 400 yards from the aircraft. The pilot and the co-pilot were fixated on putting the plane down, and the Black Hawk was traveling what they thought was in a prescribed air route, and they were likely about 100 feet too high. But where you're relying on 100 feet of separation is simply unacceptable.
Amazing.
It's incredible. So one of the telltale, I think, indications of how fatiguing and stressful this job is the fact that pilots' retirement age, mandatory retirement age, is 65.
Right.
And flight controllers is 56. That has to be the earliest retirement age in the federal.
Yeah, it's awful tough. And you know, yeah, there's every once in a while there are stories of, you know, air traffic controllers making $175,000 a year because they're doubling up on hours and stuff. And it's not uncommon for an air traffic controller to get into low six figures, but he's working the hours. You're not
right.
getting that by sitting, you know, in a training room. You're working the hours.
Right.
And the best thing is that you don't want them to work those hours.
Right.
Right.
No.
If you have a shortage of air traffic controllers, how do you reassign resources if you're the FAA to make sure that you don't have more incidents, you know, in the airspace by the airports? Like, where do they brought Peter to pay Paul? How does that work?
It is a devilishly difficult situation. Take Reagan National, which is the busiest airport, you know, on the East Coast, 45 landings and takeoffs an hour. It also has one of the highest cost of living standards.
Right.
So if you're bringing in a relatively new air traffic controller who might be making $80,000 or $90,000 after a few years, they can't live on that. So they're living an hour and a half away from their job site. And the FAA has to figure out how to balance that. I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, I had it with at the NTSB, where a NTSB investigator, you know, might a top of the line GS-15 might be making $140,000 a year, and our offices were in downtown DC. It's very difficult to live on that.
Right.
And many of them lived more than an hour away out of town.
Peter, where do they get them? Do you go to school? You get a degree in air traffic control? I mean, where do these guys come from? And how long does it take to ramp somebody up to sit in the tower?
You can get, you know, there are aviation colleges. There are, you know, Emory Riddle is probably the most famous that has
right.
a campus in Arizona and one in Florida. Some of the other state land-grant colleges have, you know, prominent aviation programs in which you could start to learn the fundamentals. But in training, it's going to take a minimum of 18 months before you're out in a tower under a supervised training, on-the-job training. So it takes a couple of years to get people online. And then you don't want to drop them into the most congested areas.
Right.
That's not right.
Right. So you got several thousand openings. You can't fill those in 6 months.
No, it's tough. It's tough.
Given the whole, I mean, you have the same problem with pilots, right? I mean, there's a shortage of pilots.
Yeah, a little less so with pilots. I mean, what's happened over the past 6 years is particularly in the regional airlines have picked up their salary levels, have improved work conditions where you can actually make a living and not kill yourself as a regional first officer or a regional captain. So, but there is a shortage of pilots, and there have been, because you know the military does not let their pilots leave. There are very enticing bonuses sure. to stay on because they need them.
And right, I mean, you can't. It's not like doctors. If there's a shortage of doctors, they turn you over to a physician assistant who yeah. can take care of the basic stuff. There isn't a pilot assistant
no.
you can turn the plane over to.
No, you got to fly it or you can't or you don't.
Right, exactly.
Let's do a quick ID. Our guest is Peter Gultz. He is the former managing director of the NTSB and the senior aviation expert for CNN. Peter, over the last 3 months, I watch a lot of CNN. And obviously, I've seen you on CNN.
Good for you.
Pete Muntean.
Fabulous.
Okay, I am so impressed with him. What is, you know, first of all, two part question. One is about Pete. What's his background and how does he have so much knowledge? I know he's a pilot, which probably is something that's very helpful. And secondly, are the networks investing more in these types of experts like yourself and others because the audience is curious and wants that information? Like, what's behind all of that?
Well, Pete is a pilot, and he is a serious student of aviation and aviation safety. He has a birthday party out at his hangar every year at a small airport just over in Maryland. That is great fun, and it's he is a really good guy, and I would say that, you know, 20 years ago, when I was at the safety board, there was what you call, you know, the beat reporters who covered aviation. New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Wall Street Journal. To a large extent, that's been cut back. There's probably maybe four or five individuals that I would say cover the beat. The way Pete does now, you know, NBC has a good one. The Wall Street Journal has got a couple of people. The Times, not so much. The Post, not so much. You know,
interesting.
And, but the industry is not, in terms of aviation safety, is not covered the way it once was.
Amazing.
And that's the problem.
And who is Mary? And
Mary Schiavo.
Yeah, Mary Schiavo.
She's an attorney, and she was the inspector general of DOT. She was appointed under George Bush I,
uh-huh.
and served for, I think, 6 or 8 years as the inspector general, and is an aviation attorney, and she's very sharp.
Right, because. Yes, I was going to say, Arnie. One thing: the networks are relying more on you, Peter and Mary and others to help round out the coverage, right? Not just the Miles and the Pete's of the world who are
Miles O'Brien, who also works part time for CNN as works for I think PBS. He is a fabulous reporter and has covered aviation and space for 25 years, and is really one. You know, I'm in awe of people like Pete and Miles. I mean, these guys are great.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Don't slight yourself, Peter. You have a heck of a knowledge base on all of this stuff.
Absolutely.
Were you tickling up the fact a little bit, Peter, that if there were more beat reporters, there'll be more early coverage of problematic issues like the Boeing 737 MAX.
That's right. I think if we had more beat reporters who are covering the industry, in a more in-depth manner than they can right now, that there would be an earlier issue raised on things like the MAX, or that I mean, Boeing clearly is a company that was in turmoil for the last 4 or 5 years, and there were warning signs, but it wasn't appropriately publicized, I don't think.
Related to that, Peter and Arnie, we were vacationing in California over the holiday, over Christmas, and there was a former project manager from Boeing that was in our hotel, and I had asked her about what it was like to work for Boeing, and she, without any hesitation, she said, "I'm very concerned about certain pro, you know." Airplanes and projects, knowing that Boeing was cutting corners and inferior parts and hardware, and it just is frightening to think about.
Well, they have had a very rough 4-year period, and I think they're getting back on track, and we'll see.
Yeah, they just recently the Fed just recently awarded them another big contract that a lot of people thought was going to go to Lockheed Martin.
Right, and
And then
there's a
it went
lot
to
of
Boeing.
controversy about that.
Yes, I'm sure there was. Not to freak out our listeners too much, there is a lot of safety redundancy on planes. It's not like just one system. When a red light goes on, there's usually means, they pay attention to it, obviously, and they do what's necessary, but that doesn't mean there's nothing backing that up.
Every safety of flight system has a redundant backup on it on a commercial aircraft. And for instance, people worry about pressurization, right? Well, there were three separate systems, independent, that controls the separate the pressurization of the aircraft. And it's very rarely that you have a serious pressurization problem. And probably the most important safety improvement that I've seen is the introduction of 16G seats, seats that can hold their place in a heavy accident. And we saw that up at the Toronto accident. Even though the plane was upside down and skidded down the runway, passengers were buckled in, they were upside down, but they were safe. And that's because the seats were designed to take that kind of abuse. And that wasn't always the case.
So we've talked a little bit about mechanical problems. We've talked about runways. We've talked about fatigue, workload. What about going through the list? What about pilot error, loss of control of in flights? Is that a common problem? Is there new technology that's in place to keep that from happening?
Well, both Airbus and Boeing have tried to design aircraft that minimize the possibility of pilot error causing an accident. And they've been very successful. In general aviation, unfortunately, it's still probably 80% pilot error. In general aviation, people buy more plane than they can handle. They don't fly it enough so that they're not completely competent in challenging situations, and they get afflicted, with this "I gotta get there" syndrome. I've got.
There's no age limit, right? I mean, they could
Oh
be
no, there's no age limit, and
eight.
you've got the. You. It's not uncommon to find 75, 78-year-old pilots still flying, which I wouldn't. But it's it's in general aviation. I give people advice. If you're not flying your plane every 2 weeks, don't fly.
Don't fly.
You've really got to be experienced.
Switching gears for 1 second here, can we talk about Elon Musk and kind of the general, sentiment around someone like himself, who's not only with what he's doing with through Doge, but what are his ultimate end goals? What is he trying to accomplish? When you start talking about privatization, that speaks right to his business and his interests.
And he has talked about privatizing the air traffic control system. I don't know. You know, he's an enigma in some ways, even though he's more of an open book than any of us ever imagined. But there is, you know, he obviously has an organization with extraordinary technical skill. SpaceX is an extraordinary effort. But the issue is, can he do all of these things as well as he thinks he can? I don't know. And it certainly is disruptive. It's certainly a challenge. I don't know how they're going to respond down the road when they have further accidents, and they will come. It's inevitable.
Well, and you know, some of what he says, you don't know if it's joking or not, but if he's serious about some of it, like he just recently said, if you're not working 80 hours a week, you can't do your job. 40 hours a week is nothing. 9 to 5 is nothing.
Right.
He sleeps on the floor of his office, you know, when he's involved in something. You can't run an air traffic system like that.
No,
that's
you can't.
Gonna be, that's going to be a disaster.
And the most disturbing thing about this chainsaw approach to cutting the federal government is that there is at the higher levels of the Trump administration, there is no respect for federal employees. Now, are there guys that and women that have been, you know, not putting in the full amount of time? Probably so. But we need them to continue to help us in transportation. We need them to continue to help us in things like getting Social Security out to people. And we need them to have some degree of respect from their leadership.
You know, because some of what they propose, you know, and you brought this up, Scott, so we're off the rails for a second here. But, you know, a lot of what they are proposing makes the interface between the population and the government worse. I mean, people complain about how long it takes to be online to get a response from Social Security or somewhere else.
Right.
Well, if you cut 30% of the workforce, you think you're going to get a better response? You think it's going to be
you think it's going to be quicker?
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
No. You know, and there's always this thing of false equivalency, which has been a mantra that I've hammered on a lot. You can always find one person that breaks the pattern. There's always a laggard. There's always somebody who there's one person or, you know, a few people that might be, you know, committing fraud or corrupt. But you can't just decimate a whole system as a way to, you know, to ferret that small percentage out. You know, the way Social Security, you know, kind of manages its money is better than most systems. The other thing is that when you put business guys in charge of all this, these systems weren't designed to be for profit. Everything in the government is not to make money. You know, we fund it. The fire department isn't there to make money. They're not there to charge every single person that they, you know, help or save, you know, $8,000, you know, send them a bill. You know, that's what public, you know, works and public services for. Some of it's subsidized, but not all of it. So you can't just attack something and say the Postal Service, you know, doesn't make any money, so we're going to privatize it and decimate it, and you're going to be paying $10 a letter, you know, as a result of that. That's not the grand bargain. That's not the grand scheme of things.
And, and the problem, I see it, is there could have been a legitimate debate about some of this stuff. But the ugliness that has been the undertone and the vindictiveness has just destroyed any possibility of bipartisanship. Not going to happen.
Right.
Yeah, not every service is intended to be run as a for-profit business. You would think with Elon Musk specifically that his private interests are getting decimated right now. Right, with respect to Tesla being down, what is the stock off?
40%, I think, 30 to 40%.
Yeah, 40% loss, and, you know, serious competition coming in for SpaceX. I'm sorry, for his satellite internet service,
Right.
right? Like there's
Skylink.
Sky, right, Starlink. There's some serious competition for those. So at some point, does he cry uncle and say, "I'm going back to what I know best"?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
I think he's in for the duration.
And what's his motivation?
The
Is
grand
it?
experiment. Can I make this thing work, like my
See, I
company?
think that's it. The underlying tone is not as though we want to make the Republic work better. What they want to do is destroy it and come up with something different. And I'm not sure that that's what people voted for.
Right. I don't think people voted for having all of their Social Security personal data shared with a
No.
private entrepreneur who's running an agency. He's not a government employee. He's not, that's not an approved,
Right.
organization. It's just been set up. If in normal times, in more balanced times, no other president I can think of in history could have get away with it, what they're getting
Yep.
away with right now.
Arnie, I don't know if your pun was intended. We are getting off the rails, but it's also with Peter, right? But
Yes.
it's a good opportunity to take a break. When we come back, our final moments with Peter Galtz. Back after these words. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Peter Galtz.
And we're back on the rails again because we only have a couple of minutes. Peter, what would you like to share with our listeners about aviation and aviation safety and the whole industry you're involved in that they may not know and that you want them to know?
Well, I think I mentioned in the last segment this whole thing about 16G seats, that the aviation has made tremendous advances in the past 20 years. The seats are stronger, so if you buckle up and you have a crash, a hard landing, you'll survive. The TCAS, which is the collision avoidance system, has worked like a charm. There hasn't been a mid-air collision involving TCAS-equipped aircraft ever. So that the system continues to be safe and it gets safer. But it needs to be treated respectfully. You can't come in with a meat axe or a chainsaw and take it apart and not expect that there won't be some blowback. And the blowback, when it comes to transportation, usually ends up in terms of accidents. So we need to keep our eye on safety, not just for aviation, but for rail and for the biggest killer of all, the highways.
Right. We have to keep those seagulls out of those engines of those planes. You read about that every once in a while.
Yeah.
Scott,
You know
any
what?
final words?
Well, I was just going to say the next time we speak to Peter, I'd love to talk a little bit about the notion of autonomous, like mass transportation, and how that technology is going to impact us from both an efficiency and a safety standpoint. Can you give us a quick 30 seconds on that?
Sure. It's being used in a number of, we see it at major airports all the time. The people movers there are not staffed with individuals. When you go from Terminal A to Terminal D, those subways are not staffed. They're autonomous. They are using autonomous vehicles to move containers at some of the larger ports in the
Right.
United States.
Right.
They're going to be using autonomous vehicles in terms of taxi cabs in more and more cities. My daughter was in San Francisco a month ago and I instructed her to only use autonomous cabs and she said it was a hell of an experience.
Waymo.
And I think you're going to see the expansion of autonomous vehicles and it will have a very positive impact. But there's bound to be an accident. And we're going to have to learn from it.
Well, I appreciate that candor, and that's a good place to leave it. Peter, thank you as always for being our guest. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys.
It was
See you
great.
soon.
Thank you.
All right, Arnie, I'll see you next week.
See you next week, Scott. You take care.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.